Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
Richard Ford was born in Jackson, Mississippi. He's published 8 novels and 4 collections of short stories, including Independence Day, The Sports Writer, The Lay of the Land, and the New York Times bestseller, Canada, which was also a finalist for the High Plains Book Award for Fiction. Independence Day was awarded both the Pulitzer Prize and the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. Let Me Be Frank With You was shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize again in 2015. His work has been translated into 28 languages. Richard Ford lives in Maine and Montana with his wife Christine. His new book, Between Them, is a 2-part memoir about the lives of his late parents. Richard, welcome to Billings. Welcome to Yellowstone Public Radio.
Nice to be with you, Corby. Thank you very much.
Your new memoir will actually be released in early May, so you're probably on a whirlwind tour of interviews and book signings all across the U.S. and in Europe?
Yeah, that's true, but it's not a hardship. I mean, one is lucky to get to do such a thing as that. If people are interested enough in your books that becomes a good idea, I'm certainly not complaining about it.
Is this the first time you've done memoir?
Not really. It's the first time I've ever done a book-length piece of memoiristic writing. I've written lots of memoiristic essays over the years about my parents, about my grandparents, growing up in Little Rock and in Mississippi and in New Orleans, as I did. So it, for me, didn't feel like much of a departure. I mean, on the one hand, I sort of want to say that if you're a writer, you write. And sometimes you write this way, and sometimes you write that way. It was nonetheless true that in writing about my parents, there was a kind of starkness to it, which I think had to do simply with the fact that I was writing fact. I was relying on fact. When I have over my many years written pieces of fiction, there's a kind of cushiony quality toward writing fiction.
You have a little more luxury to play with the character.
You do. You do. I mean, it's a little bit like Henry Moore said that in fiction at least, never think of a surface but as the extension of a volume. With fiction, there always seemed that there is a volume behind whatever surfaces I'm dealing with, and it's not a volume that's there and I find. Mm-hmm. It's a volume that I have to make up and put in place. Whereas writing memoir, which has to be factual, unless you're supposing about the facts, in which case you have to alert the reader that you're supposing.
In the book, you do investigate things, and you sort of imagine things based on photographs and your research, things that you certainly wouldn't have known about when your parents were first married, for example.
Because I wasn't there. My parents were married for 15 years before I was born, and there was never another child. I mean, I don't know what it was like, for instance, when my parents first entered my father's mother's house in Atkins, mm-hmm. Arkansas, as newlyweds. I do know that my grandmother was reluctant about my mother because they were Protestants, the Irish were, and my mother was supposed to be Catholic, although she was not Catholic, but she went to a convent school. I can't know what that day was like, but I can imagine, based on things that I do know, what actually was felt and what maybe even transpired, but it all flies under the flag of supposition. I don't aver it to be true because I don't know it to be true, but to investigate something like that, to suppose around amongst facts, is in its own way a gesture of interest. It's a gesture, in my case, of affection. And it is, you know, you write these things for readers, not for yourself. It's a way of instructing readers to pay attention to life.
So your father, Parker Ford, who looks very much like you.
He does.
Those
yeah.
early pictures are just so surprising.
Good looking guy.
Yeah, tall, good looking guy.
Blue eyes, yeah, the whole thing.
He lived at the early part of the 20th century where work was such an important part of his life. Tell us a little bit about that work.
My father came from an environment in which people worked. And for him, I think work was the ballast to life. As a writer of stories, I can't really find characters plausible until I know what they do for a living, what I make them do for a living. And I think it's because my father was that way. He worked as a traveling salesman for a company out of Kansas City, Kansas, called the Fall of Starch Company. And he traveled in his car over seven southern states selling one product and one product only, which was boxed laundry starch. And he did that from 1938 until he died in 1960. And I think it was, in a way, not as important as my mother was to him, but it was the cornerstone of his life. And not
it's
just
what
that,
one did.
Well, they lived through the mm-hmm. Depression, and he felt, I know, that he was lucky to have a job. He was good at that job. My mother, I think, was comfortable in life because they had money coming in. I think it was the undercarriage for everything that they did, and he drew some sense of his own sense of significance from being able to do that job well.
So your mother, Edna Atkins, is a very beautiful woman from Arkansas, but she was raised by itinerant parents and comes from a very colorful group of people. I think some of my favorite parts of the story was finding out about her family.
They were true Arkies. In the sense that they were from the Ozarks. Mm-hmm. I mean, my father was from west central Arkansas, but they were from way up in the sticks, way up in the northwest part, bordering on the west Oklahoma and then the north Missouri. And they had some Osage blood running through them in there somewhere. And my mother was the child of divorce. And my grandmother married a younger man. And in order to marry a younger man, she felt she needed to lie about her age. And she was only 14 years older than her own daughter. And my daughter, my mother, as you say, was very beautiful. And as a consequence of marrying this rather handsome sort of gigolo club boxer, roustabout mm-hmm. guy, Benny Shelley. She felt, I think, in some ways competitive with my young mother. And so they sent her off to convent school in Fort Smith and left her in convent school to have her out of the way until, in fact, they needed to take her out of convent school in the ninth grade and put her to work, which is what they did do. So when my mother was a ninth grader, she was running the cigar stand in the Majestic Hotel in Hot Springs, Arkansas.
The grandmother and Benny really feel like fictional characters. I just loved their story and both the danger and the caution in the story.
Yeah, they were sort of Bonnie and Clyde without the hardware.
So your parents were married for 15 years before you were born. How did the introduction of the only son into the family change the dynamics?
Well, profoundly, of course, but I was a desired child. They always wanted to have children. I kind of sometimes think they didn't know how children were made, so that when my mother finally discovered that she was pregnant, I think everybody was both elated and shocked at the same time. And when I was born, then their life, which had been, as you said before, somewhat itinerant life, living in their car, going around all those seven southern states, had to, in a way, centralize. So they had to find a place in the middle of my father's traveling territory from which he could gain the outer limits of his territory, and they chose Jackson, Mississippi, a place neither of them really had any affiliations in or had any affinity to. As I said before, they were Arkies. And so to move to Mississippi, and I know it doesn't sound like quite as profound a change as it was. I mean, to move from Arkansas to Mississippi was for them a big change. Mm-hmm. And so they were there with no friends. I was there. And this is where the title to my book comes from. I was brought into the world between them. Not only did I emerge from between them, but I came between them. It was also the case in my parents' life that even though through the whole course of my life I was loved, what was most important to my parents was what went on between them. Even though I was there, they stayed primary in each other's lives.
And that's very romantic, too. There is a real sense of love.
Yeah.
How much your mother loved your father, and I think your father very much worshipped your mother.
That's true. It seemed that way to me when I was growing up. I always kind of knew when I was growing up, even though I was an only child, that I was third among them, that each of them was primary to each other, and that I was always not a distraction and not an intruder, but just I was third. And it is, I mean, I don't have children. Christina and I don't have children, but it always seemed to me that that's the way it should be.
I totally agree. Yeah. I absolutely agree. I loved the photos throughout the book, but the photos really only tell a little part of the story. And I'm wondering, how did you go about uncovering the story of your parents' early life?
Well, I had scant bits of information, but I had enough. I mean, I had documentation. I had marriage licenses. I had death certificates. I had a few cousins who could tell me things that they had been made privy to. Most all of these people are long dead. I mean, because I was a late child, the grandparents, the aunts and uncles, they were all much older. I always thought that I really should have been older than I am if they had, you know, run true to course. Over the course of 30 years, I just kept notes. And whenever I would find a little fleck of information, I'd write it down. Whenever anybody would say something to me at a family reunion, I would write it down. Whenever I would see a picture or a document, I would make note of it. I mean, in the course of 30 years, I must have accumulated 400 different little pieces of notes. But that's what I do. Mm-hmm. That's how I go about composing something.
And then your father died very young. It was middle 50s?
55.
55 years old. And you were 15, 16 years
16,
old?
16, just barely. Mm-hmm. It was 4 days after my 16th birthday he died. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Died at home of a heart attack in my arms.
Between Them, Richard Ford's memoir about his parents, is coming out in time both for Mother's Day and Father's Day. Wonderful book. And I think we should give the audience maybe a little sample of your writing. Would you feel comfortable reading?
I'll feel happy to. The first of these two essays, which is about my father, it's called Gone, Remembering My Father. Somewhere deep in my childhood, my father is coming home off the road on a Friday night. He is a traveling salesman. It is 1951 or 52. He's carrying with him lumpy white butcher paper packages full of boiled shrimp or tamales or oysters by the pint he's brought up from Louisiana. The shrimp and tamales steam up hot and damp off the slick papers when he opens them out. Lights in our small duplex on Congress Street in Jackson are switched on bright. My father, Parker Ford, is a large man, soft, heavy-seeming, smiling widely as if he knew a funny joke. He is excited to be home. He sniffs with pleasure. His blue eyes sparkle. My mother is standing beside him, relieved he's back. She is buoyant, happy. He spreads the packages out into the metal kitchen tabletop for us to see before we eat. It is as festive as life can possibly be. My father is home again. My and my mother's week has anticipated this arrival. Edna, will you? Edna, did you? Son, I am in the middle of everything. Normal life between his Monday leavings and the Friday nights when he comes back. Normal life is the interstitial time, a time he doesn't need to know about and that my mother saves him from. If something bad has happened, if she and I have had a row, always possible. If I have had trouble in school, also possible. This news will be covered over, manicured for his peace of mind. I don't remember my mother ever saying, I'll have to tell your father about this, or wait till your father comes home, or your father will not like that. He confers, they confer, the administration of the week's events, including my supervision, onto her. If he doesn't have to hear it when he's home, ebullient and smiling with packages, it can be assumed nothing so bad has gone on, which is true, and to that extent, is fine with me.
Between Them is both a healing meditation on the nature of family and a son's gift to the memory of his parents. Richard Ford, Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. It's a great pleasure, Corby. Thank you.
Born in 1941 in Billings, Montana, painter, sculptor, and rancher, Ted Waddell is one of the West's most celebrated contemporary artists. His landscapes with black Angus cattle, horses, and bisons, painted in an abstract expressionist technique, can be found in all the major museums in the West and numerous private collections across the United States. Well, a new book, Ted Waddell, My Montana, Paintings and Sculptures, 1959 to 2016, has just been released. Written and produced by Rick Newby and published by Drumalon Institute of Helena, the volume includes a dozen essays celebrating the life and work of Ted Waddell. Welcome, Ted.
Thanks, Corby. It's nice to be with you. It really feels like a family reunion. As you know, you and I go back to, I think, 1970.
73, I think. Ted was teaching at the University of Montana when I first enrolled up in Missoula.
Well, at any rate, the book that we've been working on, Rick Newby has written widely about the arts, and especially about the arts in Montana. The work that he did on the Poindexter collection was really pivotal, and he's also a pretty good poet.
Oh, he's a wonderful poet.
Yeah, and so my wife, Lynn Campion, who's a writer and a photographer, she suggested to me that we do a coffee table book, and I didn't want to do a coffee table book, except I'm tempted to buy some legs so we could screw into the bottom and make a coffee table. But we didn't really want a book that was just about me, because I feel like this segment of history that I've experienced, and you don't know that until you're moving through it. I mean, I think when you have less history ahead of you than you have behind you, that maybe you get interested in it. At any rate, I went to meet with Rick, and he agreed to do this. It's terrific, and it's more, to me, it's about us. It's about us in Montana.
Right. This is really a book full of stories. There's some chronological aspect to it, early life, ranching, whatever, but I think of it more as a storybook about your life in Montana.
Oh, I agree. In a way, you don't know about these things until you can look at them in retrospect. And Rick helped me tremendously to do that. I thought I didn't have any family history. You know, we didn't have a family tree. We had a Hanukkah bush, you know. Mm-hmm. But in his research for this book, he discovered on his own, it wasn't me, I didn't know, that my grandfather knew Charlie Russell. My grandfather was in a cow camp with Charlie Russell. My grandfather shod Charlie's favorite horse, Monty. My grandfather was also a writer and published, didn't know that. And you'd love this, he invented and patented a manure spreader. So the gene pool, I have the DNA.
It runs deep.
It runs deep. And again, thanks to Rick discovering these things, or I would have never known.
Talk about your early life, because you really grew up in Laurel, right?
I did.
Tell a little bit about that. I actually heard just the other day the story, and I didn't realize about your father, which I think is so fascinating. So talk a little bit about Laurel.
My dad was, he worked for the railroad. He was a painter, but he painted boxcars. And my first memory of him was smelling his clothes, which smelled like paint. And so he was very inspirational to me. And then we would go to the library, he and I, with grocery bags, and we would fill them with books. And then he and I would sit and read together.
Wow.
You know, we did that. We would read, in 2 weeks, we'd read a dozen books.
As an artist, you started fairly young. I know you went to school at Eastern Montana College, well, Montana State University now, but you enrolled there at the beginning?
Yeah, it was almost by accident. I had some friends, Les Frank and a couple other guys were going to go down and start up at Eastern. I didn't have anything to do, so I went with them. And I started. And I was going to do pre-architecture. And art was a part of that activity. And for some reason, you're not supposed to do this until you're upperclassmen. I got into a painting class with Isabel Johnson.
Ah.
And within, I would say, 6 or 7 weeks of knowing her, I decided I didn't want to do anything in my life except paint. Mm-hmm. And make art. And that was 58 years ago.
There are two of your early sculptures on campus at Montana State Billings.
They had a commission for $3,000. And so I sent a model and whatnot. And he said, okay, you can do it, but we can't give you any money up front. So I mortgaged my pickup and borrowed the money to make this piece. So I made the piece, and I had all my neighbors come over. It's 24 feet high. And so I had all my neighbors come over and have a beer with me and load it on this trailer that I had built. Well, it was too heavy for the trailer, so it broke the back end off. So I had to jack it up and re-weld it. And to pack it, I got old mattresses. It was the darndest thing you ever saw. And because it was so long, I had to have the highway patrol come and inspect it. So I had to put a taillight at the end of this piece. I drove it 350 miles to Billings.
I think that story should be at the bottom of the sculpture, maybe.
Well, and then as a footnote, it took me 18 months to pay off the loan on my truck.
Actually, sculpture is probably not what you're most well known for. It's certainly in the last 20 years, you've made a name for yourself as a painter. What was that first point of recognition where all of a sudden you weren't just a Montana man painting that created who Ted Waddell is?
I think it was Claire List. Claire List was a curator for the Corcoran Museum in Washington, D.C., and she came out, she was engaged by the Western States Arts Foundation to pick a show, mm-hmm. which turned out to be the Survey of American Painting that year. And so she came out and she went to see Isabel's work and mine and a number of other people. And she picked me, and we're sitting at lunch with Donna Forbes, and she said, well, I'd like to have your work for this show. And I said, okay, how long will you need to have it? And she said, oh, about 3 years. And I said, boy, I don't know, that might be too long. And Donna kicked me under the table. So we were in the show, and it was an amazing story because they said they gave us, the cigarette company, Lorillard, gave us each $500 to come to the opening. Well, we didn't have any money. So Betty went down and bought formals, little formals for the girls, and they look like Easter eggs. And so we go. I called them up and I said, black tie was optional. Well, I didn't know what that was. So I called them up and asked them, and they said, well, that's, they told me what it was. And I said, well, in mold, black ties when you wear your new jeans. I was quoted in the Washington Post everywhere, got huge coverage. So we go to the opening. And I had a big cowboy hat on and a green suit. It was the only thing I had. Everybody else was in gray and black. So I'd been on the Montana Arts Council board, and this was during the embargo. So I was introduced to the Secretary of Commerce, and I said, I'm going to straighten out this thing about this embargo. I'm going to call up Deng Xiaoping and do this. His eyes got so big, I thought he was going to faint. He said, you can't do it. And I said, oh, yeah, I can. They took him away right away. And as a result of all of that, I was interviewed by Voice of America, CNN, everything. It was just, and then galleries picked me up because of that.
Isn't that interesting? You didn't know any better, right?
You were
just speaking your mind. Well, I also remember when I was, I think, in graduate school, maybe still in college, when Newsweek did the big survey of Western art, and it was the entire sort of West, the 12 states, and over half of the artists were from Montana.
That was pretty amazing, and that was due to Mark Stevens. And Mark Stevens has his grandfather, Colonel Stevens, had a ranch on, I think it's Big Elk Creek near Tudot. And so Mark has really strong ties to Montana and is a wonderful writer. He wrote also for Vanity Fair, and then he did a Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of William de Kooning. Mm-hmm. And so he did this. And again, part of this was due to Donna's influence. Donna, I don't know how she did it, but she came.
Tenacity, I think.
Well, yeah, I know about that too. Anyway, it was incredible. It was Pat Zents and Deborah Butterfield and
John Buck.
John Buck, and yeah, it was a bunch of us. So it was pretty amazing.
So I have one last question for you, Dad. What are you working on now?
I have two other children's books that are complete. I mean, they've not been published. One again was Memories of Childhood, and the other one is called Calving Stories. And then I'm thinking about a sequel to the golf book, which would be Tucker Plays the Back Nine. Because men, when they get older, the sense of color and sense of design really goes south, so you can have great fun with that. And then I'm working on a book, which I hope to have finish in the next few weeks, that I've been working on for about 20 years, about stories about my life and times and running cattle in the bars and people I know and have known. And then to do also with the land and what we do with the land. The working title is called Cheatgrass Dreams, because when the land gets stressed, the first thing it takes over is cheatgrass. And so I've been working on that for a long, long time.
Would that be an illustrated?
Yes.
Yes.
They're illustrated, and I've done little drawings for some of the pages and that sort of thing. It's getting close to being done.
So, Ted, thank you for being with us today. And the new book, Ted Waddell's My Montana, is about 288 pages, 185 color images, and 40 black and white images. It will be available in bookstores all across our region. And you'll be doing a tour of some of the famous haunts in Montana. Is that true?
This is true. I'm looking forward to that if my liver can stand it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Nauman. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.